This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, I'm with Richard Smart. How do you describe yourself? Do you see yourself as a viticulturist or...?
Yeah, viticulturist is a fair description.
Okay, we're actually here in Barcelona with the Climate Change Conference, and you've just done a fantastic presentation on effects of climate change on vines.
Yeah.
Just some of the stuff that came up that I thought was quite interesting. You started out, you described state terrorism possibly as polluting the atmosphere, and
yeah,
that's quite a political thing. That's quite a strong statement.
I think terrorism of the future will be seen to be polluting the Earth's atmosphere. I think political divisions over state boundaries are going to get, well, more fuzzy when we think about we all have the atmosphere in common.
Yeah.
And countries that continue to pollute with no regard for other countries that feel the impact are going to be viewed internationally in a poor light. And I think the word terrorism applies, because what is a terrorist? A terrorist is someone who does damage to others without regard of how much damage or where it is.
Probably fits. You did sort of scathe the industry a wee bit for our packaging. You sort of talked about half the weight and half the volume is taken up in packaging.
Yeah, well, if you think of a case of wine, about half the weight and half the volume is in the packaging. And given that wine is a commodity that's traded so much, I think it's about time the sector did review its packaging. You know, soft drink people did it 20 years ago. Beer people are starting to do it now. Why not wine?
No, for sure. Although, you look at some of the packaging options around, like PET or Tetra Pak, and they're not really for long shelf life.
But they don't have to be, you know. Let's face it, most wine is bought for consumption that evening. Maybe your listeners are people who have extensive cellars and put wine down, but the bulk of wine in the world isn't drunk that way.
If you go to that situation where maybe only the wines for long cellaring go into glass and everybody moves to some sort of other format, won't that almost create a perception of a two-tier wine, so that the non-glass wines may be seen as inferior? And that, is that maybe the driver for staying with glass?
It could be. But, you know, what's wrong with that? More expensive wine costs you more money, so there's already a two-tier system, isn't there?
Fair enough. Okay, getting on to some of the topics you covered in the presentation. You've done some work on looking at different climates and how the climates are going to change. You know, in a broad brush, what do you think are the big changes that global warming is going to occur for wine?
Well, let me try and encapsulate it for you in a few sentences. The wine world as we know it now is the product of a couple of hundred years or more of stable temperatures. Therefore, we have wine regions scattered around the world, and those in the old world in particular are discrete regions that have developed reputations for excellence of one or a few varieties. Now, that's fine. What happens if the climate changes? Let's take a French example. Bordeaux, Greater Bordeaux, has developed a reputation for Cabernet Sauvignon. The Bordelais would argue it's the best Cabernet Sauvignon in the world. Well, that's another issue. That's their position. Now, what happens when the climate changes? Cabernet Sauvignon will not be so well suited to Bordeaux. Now we've got a problem. And it could be said that if you go back 30 years ago, the best vintages, or the vintages that made the best wine, were those that were warmer and drier. And over the last 20 or so years, we've had a succession of warm vintages. The wines have been good. What happens in the next 20 years when it gets even warmer?
Yeah, for sure.
Are the Bordelais going to say, oh, we've had to rethink what's a good Cabernet? We actually believe what's a good Cabernet is the one like they're now growing in the Languedoc. Do you think that's likely?
I think they'll try.
Oh, they'll obviously try, but, you know, maybe within 30 years I'll be starting to argue the merits of their Grenache or their Carignan or something.
So do you think that that regions like Bordeaux or, you know, Australia, they're going to have to change the grape varieties that they're growing?
The quick answer is yes. We either change the regions or we change the varieties. If we're in a present cool region like Germany or Alsace, that's not much of a problem. We'll grow the varieties as suited to present warmer regions. And the warm regions like Bordeaux will be okay because they'll be able to grow the varieties that are now grown in the present hot regions. However, when we consider the present hot regions, and the south of France isn't particularly hot by world standards, but here in Spain there's some very hot regions, in Australia, in South Africa, in California, in Chile. What happens to them? They have nowhere to go. If you look at what they do produce in hotter regions now, they produce table grapes or grapes for drying. They don't produce wine grapes. So we have a problem with our existing hot regions.
You mentioned that the US will actually start to contract as a wine-producing region. Why don't they just move north?
What, and go into Canada?
Well, no, you've got...
They'll be no longer US.
Well, you've got Washington State, which is still quite a cool region. Why don't they just move further up the coast?
Well, they can. And, in fact, the guy who'll talk tomorrow will talk about that. And they can certainly go nearer the coast, too, because the current in California is very cold. They're lucky in that regard. Not all places in the world have a cold current near their coast. So they will go north and they'll go closer to the coast, but the area that's suitable for grape production will still contract. And we know this in Australia, it'll contract southwards as well.
Yep, and maybe open up Tassie a bit more?
Yeah, although Tassie's not very big, but yeah, sure, it will.
It's not just the movement of vines that are going to be moving, there's pests as well. What sort of disease pressures are going to happen as things change?
Well, that's probably the first sign we'll have of climate change. Of course, climate change has been documented as already affecting the world's wine industry for the last 20 or so years. People don't realise it and they don't talk about it because these changes are subtle and they're small, but they are going on. However, insect distribution can be, depending on the species, quite temperature sensitive, and it's probably one of the first signs that we'll see is that insect pests will move, and, you know, that, as I say, it'll be the first sign we'll see. For example, now in southern Germany, they have a problem with a serious vine disease called bois noir, which is spread by an insect, and that disease is moving northwards into southern Germany because the insect is moving northwards as it warms up.
You also mentioned in your speech the multicoloured Asian lady beetle.
Yeah.
You said it when it gets squished or gets upset, it produces some...
Methoxypyrazines. They're actually the compounds that make Sauvignon Blanc smell nice.
Yeah.
But that's a good methoxypyrazine in Sauvignon Blanc. There's some really horrible ones. And they're in the multicoloured Asian lady beetle. Interestingly, it's been found in the UK, and if you look up on the web, you'll find it spreading rapidly in the UK. I haven't heard of it yet being in a vineyard, but it's a horrible little pest. Because it gets in the bunches, and when you pick the bunches, it doesn't like being disturbed, so it puts out this stink. And it's such a powerful stink, it can contaminate a lot of bunches, a lot of wine. And also it gets in your house in the winter.
Oh, really? What's the smell of?
Any analogy that comes to mind is not the sort of thing I want to say on a respectable wine show like yours. Let me just say nothing pleasant.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. One of the effects of climate change is obviously increased alcohol across the board and maybe a loss of acidity in a lot of the wines. Is there anything that the grape growers can do to mitigate some of those effects?
Yeah, sure. They can pick their grapes earlier.
Yep.
That's all they've got to do. This, I mean, you do get higher alcohol in hot regions because the flavours take longer to develop. But this current fad of high alcohol wines needs to be knocked on the head very quickly. And all we've got to do is go and harvest the grapes earlier.
Won't you get different flavour ripeness and tannins and all that?
That's the mythology of it.
Is it?
Yeah, because it's mythology.
I've always been told that's what happens, so what's...
Yeah, but who do you talk to? But you probably talk to oenologists or winemakers, and they're the people who perpetuate this myth. Probably you believe in this myth that old vines make better wines too, but again, that's another myth. No, these are just words that people toss around. You probably know that the Californians have this concept of hang time. The longer they leave the grapes, the better they'll be.
Or riper.
Yeah, and the net result is the wines are more alcoholic. The flavours don't change measurably, and we just end up with higher alcohol wines. And I know, in fact, the origin of this term, hang time, because I was present when it was first used, actually I should say physiological ripeness, and it was coined by an oenologist in California, and her marketing department picked it up. And it's become now part of the mythology.
When I've spoken to winemakers and they taste grapes before picking and they say that the flavour changes, you're laughing a lot.
Yeah. Well, firstly, you should challenge the word winemakers. It's an abomination of the English language. People don't make wine, yeast do. So if you're going to use the term winemaker, you can call me a grape maker.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, I'm not a grape maker, I'm a viticulturist. People who make wine are oenologists. All they do is to regulate a biological process. If you get a bunch of table grapes and leave it in a bowl on your table, you'll end up with wine after a couple of weeks. Right?
Not
it's
the
a
best
natural
stuff.
Process, isn't it? Of course it won't be much good.
I did try to grow grapes and make wine when I was a kid, about 10, and all I ended up with was mould.
Yeah, sure, you do. I mean, that's why we have technology of winemaking. It's called oenology.
Yep.
Right? We have technology of grape growing. It's called viticulture. But this term winemaker suggests that these people actually make the wine, and it's led to a class of egotist. These people believe that they've got a magical touch. In fact, most wine is made in a vineyard. I, as a viticulturist, can do more to influence wine quality than most oenologists. Trust me. So if anyone's going to be called a winemaker, it should be me, not these not these people who press buttons on crushers. But that's very important to understand this because, you see, the winemakers like to think that they go out in the vineyard and taste the grapes and they can determine the time of harvest. And they'll say, and they sort of chew the grapes a bit, scratch their bum and look up in the air and they say, doesn't quite have the flavour yet, but I tell you what, we'll pick it next Tuesday. And that's what they do. Yep. And I've seen these people operate. And the sad fact of the matter is, for most grape varieties, they cannot taste the flavours that are present in wine.
What about Sauvignon Blanc? That's supposed to be reasonable.
Sauvignon Blanc's one of them.
But you can.
But you hear, yes, it is, because your saliva breaks down the flavour precursor. But for most varieties, you know, Chardonnay, they can't taste Chardonnay flavour. They're just kidding themselves, and it's just that they want to be in control. They imagine the most important decision in viticulture is the time of harvest. That's a demonstrable nonsense. And if they want to be out in the vineyard and influence wine quality, and I encourage them, they're 2 months too late. The important decisions have already been made.
Okay.
But so anyway, let me not go on about enologists. We'll be here all day.
That's a wee bugbear of yours.
No, it's just that the buggers get more highly paid than I do. I think it's unfair. They also get more credit than I do. It's grossly unfair.
We'll come back to this later on, but we'll crack on with climate change first for a bit. One of the things you talked about in your presentation was, you know, we talk about average temperatures going up by 1 degree, 2 degrees, but you also talked about the standard deviation of the temperature becoming more variable. So you're going to land up with a bigger range of temperatures along with that increased average. Does that mean the temperatures could be cooler as well sometimes?
Yeah, sure, it does. I mean, the predictions by the climate scientists are that as well as the average getting higher for temperature, they'll be more variable. And it means we will have more days of extreme heat, more days of cold, I suppose, but it's the extreme heat that does the damage from a wine quality point of view.
There seems to be a magic number that you used in your presentation of 35 degrees. Well, you talked about
the mean July temperature. I mentioned 25, which is the average temperature of July in the Northern Hemisphere for wine-growing regions. We tend not to grow grapes at a higher temperature than that. Now, basically what happens is that the vines don't create as much flavour compound at high temperatures as they do at cooler temperatures. There are some varieties that are adapted to it, but not too many. But my point is we've got plenty of time to breed vines that will be capable of producing good wine at high temperatures. And I'll give us an example, the excellent breeding work they've been doing in Germany and other places for the last 50 years, where they've bred grapes for cool regions, quite the opposite. But they've done a fantastic job. You can now, for example, grow vines commercially in Denmark. I mean, it's amazing. And you can do that because of these vines that have been bred in Germany. So I'm sure that we'll be able to do it for varieties well suited to hot regions.
Okay. In terms of the big winners and losers with global warming, what countries do you think are going to be going well? Which ones are going to lose out?
Well, the ones that will lose out essentially are Northern Hemisphere countries, and that's because in the south there'll be less global warming because we have more oceans. And so the countries that will do best are Chile in particular, but also Argentina, New Zealand, Tasmania, where I live, which is an island off the south coast of Australia, parts of Australia. South Africa's a bit far north. So they're really the ones that are going to see less change.
They're the ones that normally seem to have a lot of water around them or altitude.
Well, they've got a lot of water around them.
I was thinking Argentina, that was the odd man out.
Argentina, but you see, it goes very far south, Argentina. And in the southern hemisphere, one of the ways, well, you've got two ways to get it cooler. You either go further south towards the pole or you go up.
Yep.
And in the instance of Chile, they can also go nearer the coast because they've got a very cold ocean current there.
That's the Humboldt Current, isn't it? Okay, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.